Hello and welcome to Platforms and Pitfalls. I'm Rowan.
And I'm Blue.
And we are here to talk about game design again. And this month, we are talking about dominant strategies. And in fact, we're going to be talking about dominant strategies and how to deal with them over the next several months. So right now, we need to have a conversation about what actually are dominant strategies and what they are not. So dominant strategies aren't necessarily the best strategies in the game overall. What we're really isolating is like the strategies that you tend towards instead of exploring other options, I guess, is how I am thinking of them.
In the best sense, I would say dominant strategies are something that guides the player because it's easy to digest. It's something for the player to latch onto to be able to immediately start tinkering with the game. In the worst sense, which is a lot of the cases that we're going to be talking about in terms of examples, a dominant strategy is something that prevents the player from really exploring the game's design space and really getting all that the game has to offer.
And so we're going to look at how games prevent players from latching onto a single idea and just plowing on through with that and encouraging them to take different options. This month, we're looking at repetition mitigation. So trying to prevent players from just simply repeating the same action over and over again. And for our first game, we're going to talk about Super Scribblenauts. Super Scribblenauts is a 2010 DS puzzle game by Fifth Cell where you get to use the English language to solve puzzles. So each level of Super Scribblenauts has a question it presents, either an objective or which can be as much as get from A to B. It could be to make someone happy by providing them with an object or any number of things. They're all very stages, very different. But your tool set to do this is the English language. In the game, you can tap a button to conjure any item and you can modify any item by using an adjective. And you have the entire dictionary to work with, excluding copyright and vulgarity. Obviously, when presented with such a system, you will tend towards certain solutions. And the first game had a big issue where players would simply use the wings to give the main character flight and then just solve all their puzzles like this for the most part. This game, Super Scribblenauts, is an enhanced version of the original game with some extra content that tries to mitigate just using the same words to solve every problem. That's a really simple solution. Every time you finish a level, you're asked to play it again without repeating any vocabulary you've already used in that stage. And once you complete it the second time, you get that option again for a total of 3 rewards, which act more or less like stars or moons in Mario or something.
These aren't mandatory, right? You can keep going without them.
That's right. So much like any of, puzzle games, you can get the base reward and be content with that, but eventually you are going to be gated by the next stage requires 12 shinies. And if you don't have them, you might have to go back and like try repeating another level. Much like in Mario, like sometimes you don't have enough moons or stars or whatever the currency is in the game. And so it's a really, really simple system. It's very blunt about what it's trying to do, but it's kind of interesting. So for an example, very early in the game, it's a very simple puzzle, but you have a fireman, a doctor, and a policeman, and you're just asked to give them each an object that makes them happy. And, you know, as adults, we can probably find 3 different ways to bring each of them an object that would make them happy. It's worth stating that this is a game that is ideally targeting younger children, so it's a little bit more easily leaning towards pushing their vocabulary, but as you get levels that are more complicated, it can be harder to find solutions that don't repeat words. But the really interesting side effect of this system is that once players are forced to be a little bit creative, they tend to be a lot more creative. And you see like ridiculous playthroughs of people trying to solve every puzzle with Cthulhu or something, which in the original game, you saw much less of because with the power to do anything, players will do the easiest thing.
Path of Least Resistance is definitely one of the aspects that affect dominant strategies. Once you find something that works, why bother experimenting? A lot of times you get into a game and you get into this groove and you just want to do what works. in a puzzle game, especially like Scribblenauts, one of the goals of the game is to kind of challenge the player to be a bit more creative, think a bit more outside of the box. So yeah, the game definitely allows you to just give out the same answers because those are legitimate and valid answers, but you would get more out of it if you, you know, applied a bit of creativity.
Potentially, like, the argument would go, oh, the game should be more specific or require more outlandish things, but the game has an incredibly broad toolset. And because of how, like, language knowledge work, you can't assume that every player knows all the words, which seems like a weird thing to say in a game design thing. But, yeah, so there's a balance of, like, how you're encouraging just this little nudge just pushes players to be a little bit more creative.
There's another side to that as well, right? Because with puzzle games, you have a few different breeds and a few different classes of them. Sometimes puzzle games are hyper-specific. There is one way to do it, and it is the developer-intended way to do it. Point-and-click adventures tend to fall into this, where there is this one solution, and sometimes it's a bit obtuse, but it's the one solution you have. Scribblenauts is in a very nice place to be, and I'm not saying that one is better than the other. Like, you get super interesting things from the former. But if you're able to be a very broad toolbox kind of puzzle game and say, yeah, there are many ways to do this, you don't actually want to limit yourself. You're going to get overlaps between puzzles like that. And so this is a very smart way to incentivize creativity as opposed to punishing boring, samey behavior. You know what? I'm like, there's a nicer way to say that, but yeah.
I think it's really important that it chose three repetitions.
Yeah.
Because with two repetitions, it'd be easy enough to find an effectively identical solution. And with three, for a lot of people, it probably isn't that hard to go, oh, I can use wings, I can use a Pegasus, I can use a jetpack. But even so, it is just pushing you that little bit more, because for any solution, two words wouldn't be too difficult to improvise. Three is just, yeah, that extra step.
It also follows the rule of three, which is nice.
Yeah, three is a neat number. Lots of games use threes.
Yep.
Getting 3 stars in your Angry Bird levels.
Matching three in Bejeweled.
Yeah, this came out just during, like, the big iOS is going to be the new thing fad. Because Angry Birds was 2008, but that's not relevant to this discussion.
No, it's not.
So there's not much to say more about Scribblenauts. It's just a really simple, effective, brute forcey kind of way to get players to explore their options.
Yeah, but without just saying no, saying, yeah, please try.
Because the joy of this game is that you can do whatever you can think of. So it would be kind of annoying if the game just kept going, you can't use wings because they're too powerful. Nope, Scribblenauts' goal is that you can summon any object in the game and it acts approximately how you would expect it to. Within, like, simple AI rules. Like,
yeah.
You summon God, you can't use him to, like, just create continents and countries and people. But he's like a guy on some clouds who's really hard, who can't really be killed. That's what you expect God to be.
Yep.
And Scribblenauts is happy to throw that out for you to do and work out how you can use him to solve your puzzle. Our next game looks at this in a much softer sense through limiting how frequently you can use your powerful options. The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, a 2017 Nintendo developed and published game that was an open-world Switch launch title. And the key system that we're talking about here is the much-derided weapon durability system, which much has been said about and is not especially popular with lots of people. But the basic reason why I feel, that that system is there is to encourage players to look at various options, because the weapons in this game are all, or the options in this game, are all pretty interesting and all pretty distinct, and so it's very easy to develop favorites. But between your arrows and your weapons, you have limited uses of those items, and it forces you to end up using things at points that you might not necessarily tend towards. And Breath of the Wild's, like, core goal is to ask you to interact with the environment in lots of different ways. And so if you start challenging every situation with a sword or a spear, you're just missing out on a lot of the interesting play space that Nintendo really wants you to explore. Eventually, in the game, almost as if to prove the point as to why this sort of system is important, you obtain an item that is effectively ignoring this system, the Master Sword. The Master Sword has a limitation. You can only use it for a short amount of time, which usually is about the time of a single encounter. So it has a pseudo durability, but once you get that, many players stop really engaging with the items as a whole outside of the Master Sword and just like have a backup reserve for when that sword runs out. But it's always the go-to move once you have an effectively free infinite option.
A bit of that has to do with loss aversion. Players don't like to feel like they're using up a finite resource, and you look at the Master Sword and you go, well, it goes away, but then it comes back, so I can use it forever, and I don't have to go and get new ones. But that's not necessarily the big thing here, right? Like, it's kind of incorrect to think that, because you got to the point of the Master Sword without any problem. So obviously you can cycle through a huge amount of weapons and that's not going to be a big deal.
When you get the Master Sword, the game is kind of trying to push you towards, and now is the time to finish this off.
Yeah.
You still don't have to, because in Breath of the Wild, you never have to fight Ganon until you want to. But it is at this point that you start interacting with a lot of the systems less, because you simply don't have to.
So let's focus a bit more on when a dominant strategy is the most prevalent and perhaps damaging to a player's experience towards the beginning of the game, when you're learning and exploring all that the game has to offer. So you don't have the Master Sword early on, and it'll be quite a while before you do. So you are forced to cycle through a variety of different weapon types in order to get through the game, because the durability, even if you prefer only swords, no amount of swords is going to be enough early on. You won't find that many. So you will be forced to eventually use other weapon types. You can probably ignore some weapon types. You probably find enough to say that I never want to use a hammer, but you'll end up using spears and axes and swords otherwise. Is that right?
More or less, but here's the extra trick the game gives you. Everything's limited, and every now and then you'll fight guardians that have incredibly powerful weapons, like several tiers above what you currently have. And though that might be an axe after you decide you never use an axe again, but this axe has 100 attack power, which is a lot higher than your current weapons, maybe 10 times even. So you can't not use it.
Or you can, but then you suffer for it.
Yeah, sorry, you can not use it, but in general, Breath of the Wild pushes enough difficulty at you that you'll want to make the most of this.
It's really just that. It's just that very simple system of early on, scarcity is a thing. You just don't have a lot of options, so you're forced to explore. By the point where scarcity is not as much of an option, the game finally presents you with a potentially infinite resource, because by that point you will have developed a style that you like. And it's a bit unfortunate that it is a sword, and there are, like, you can't just say, I don't want a master sword, I want a master spear. You don't have that option, even if you end up liking a specific other weapon type more than the sword. But if that is the case, you are likely in a position by the time you can get the Master Sword to be able to just have as many spears as you want and to only use that. It'll require a bit more effort on your part to go out and scour the world and basically hoard them, but it's possible. So at the point where you have already explored the options that the game has given you, it is content to sit back and say, now you can play however you want. And if you have a quote-unquote dominant strategy, a preferred strategy, go for it, because you've already explored our space and you know that's what you want.
Yeah, that sounds basically it. And it's worth saying, we've talked mostly about weapons here specifically, but part of what Breath of the Wild's encouraging you to do is use all your options. You have a variety of simple magic spells that each of them are unlimited in usage, but are all a lot less convenient than weapons, than consumer weapons. And so it encourages you to use your spells and the environment in like the unique ways to complement your limited weapon usage. Which, if you just had a single sword you could use infinitely, players would not even start exploring the environmental effects, because there's not enough value to do so. It's also worth noting that Link doesn't have... he can't punch. If you don't have any of your weapons left, you have to use a lot of inconvenient resources in really clever ways.
You're not helpless, but you're stuck doing things like waiting for bombs to cool down and chucking it.
Yeah, waiting for bombs to cool down, chucking it, using magnesis to try and use random environmental options to attack enemies with, stasis to stop enemies moving, and none of these are like clear, good, effective combat options. They are all like forcing puzzle solution tools, into combat in awkward ways.
Which can be fun for some people. Worth noting.
It's super fun, and when you have situations you can create cool situations with, it's really fun and interesting.
Yeah.
But it's not. The game would not be, you wouldn't end up exploring those situations if you didn't run into moments when you had like only a single weapon left that you really want to save for a harder enemy than what you're currently fighting. Yeah, so it was Wrath of the Wild. We're talking about how you lose options specifically if you overuse them. Our next game is looking more at weakening options through repetition rather than outright removing them. Super Smash Bros. Brawl, developed by Sora Limited and Game Arts and published by Nintendo for the Wii in 2008. So Super Smash Bros., like many fighting games, has moves that are good, as you would hope in a fighting game. Many players tend to find a move they like and use it repeatedly at lower levels of play. Smash Bros.' solution to this issue, which specifically targets like lower to medium skill players, is that with each move usage, it gets weaker and weaker. In fact, the specific system of this is that the game tracks the last 10 moves a character hit with, and for every repeated instance of that move in that list, it gets weaker and weaker. This can take a move that would usually kill in a single hit in a certain situation to being barely able to get them off the stage. It's still powerful, but it's maybe 60 to 50% as powerful as it used to be. And this is a big issue in a lot of fighting games in low to medium skill levels. Certain moves that are easy to do, but kind of hard to work around. And this is a subtle way to mitigate players just spamming a certain move or ability.
Of note, neither of us believe that most casual players will ever notice the system. It's there, and it's going to help them, but...
It's a weird one because it's a little too subtle to be noticed, unless you're told it exists. And strong players will generally know in their heads that it exists, but are generally just coincidentally using enough different moves that while it will crop up, it will never get to a moment that will severely change a match. Like, there might be points when you get like two or three instances of the same move in the list, but you'll never get a point where you've got all 10 instances and the move is only half as strong as it should be.
The better the player as well, Smash Brothers is one of those kinds of games that you start to learn that there is no one good move for every situation. If they're slightly above you and to the right, it's very different from if they're slightly below you. You would use two very different moves there.
That's generally true. There are certain characters that will generally have certain moves that they use quite often. Like for a random instance in the current Smash Brothers, Young Link's neutral air is useful in a lot of situations compared to certain characters. But, like, those are exceptions, not rules. In general, there are moves good for certain situations. Smash aims for a very broad audience and is trying to mitigate a really common issue at low-level play, specifically.
And the subtlety of it is kind of a problem because, as you said, it's to encourage players to explore more than just the one move. But sometimes... all a player who's just picked up the controller for Smash for the first time wants to do is jump in the air as Kirby and press down special. And there's very little to discourage them from doing that because if the opponent isn't practiced, it's actually going to work a decent amount of the time.
And all it will do is just give the opponent more time to be annoyed by the situation.
Yeah.
As opposed to actually solving the situation.
And honestly, the amount of reduction of power that we're talking about here, they're probably not going to notice it compared to the... you know, the excitement of, I hit someone.
Because the lowest a move goes is 55% of the original power, which is a lot. But given the way that Smash's damage system increases knockback over the course of damage, means that it doesn't look like it's getting that much weaker in general.
You feel like, I did, yeah, that looks like I did the same amount at worst case. At best case, you still actually launch them a fair amount because... it's not going to be that much of a difference.
Smash has this system that is trying to actively discourage move repetition, but it's very soft and very subtle. It's there, but it's not like actively in your face. Our next game is extremely explicit with its system.
Skullgirls was developed by Revenge Labs, currently known as Lab Zero Games, was released in 2012. It is an indie tag fighting game. And at its core, it has the basic fighting game goal of win against your opponent. Now, if you really break it down and go to the extreme ends of it, you can say that their best shot at getting this done is to not let your opponent play. If your opponent cannot retaliate against you and you can keep beating them up, you're going to deplete their life bar first and win. That's not very fun for both players. So, a lot of fighting games aim to, mitigate that somewhat. In Skullgirls, we have a very explicit tutorialized system that, internally they just call the infinite prevention system. Because in this game, if left unchecked, you can just put someone in a combo that goes on forever and take all of their life away.
Which is bad.
Yeah, that's mostly bad. One-player games where there are two people holding controllers tend to not be fun for one of those players. So, very briefly, and there's a bit of technicality to this, the way the infinite prevention system works is, if you keep doing a combo that repeats the same moves too many times, your opponent just gets an opportunity to say no. They can push a button and just stop your combo.
And they change color, and there's indications to it. If you don't know the system exists, you might not notice that it's triggerable, but your character has visual cues to help you know that you can do this. I think there's hit spots that also differ after a certain point too, to make sure that you know.
There's a lot of specifics that go into this as to how smart the game wants to be to prevent an infinite from happening, but still allow the creativity for players to be able to express themselves and be creative in their combos and show off that they can do a lot of different hits and do interesting looking combos and stuff like that. And that's a very fine balance to hit.
Because Skullgirls is really trying to emulate some older fighting games that really just relish in like spectacle and doing like really clever, insane things. And that's a perfectly reasonable goal for a game to have, even if it does come at the cost of some level of player interaction.
It's of note that while this is kind of the other opposite extreme end of very explicit, as opposed to the Smash Brothers example, which is never spoken of in game, you just kind of know that that system exists. Skullgirls 1 is talked about in the tutorials. Both still suffer from the same thing where a new player who's picking up the controller for the first time and, has never sat down at the game or been explained how the game works before will not know that this system is in place, may not understand how to really use the system. So it's not about how complex a system is that makes a dominant strategy mitigation tool effective or approachable. There's a lot of factors here, but it's there. It does exist. And once you put a bit of time, Skullgirls is definitely a game you want to sit down and try to learn as opposed to just sit down and try to pick up. It's a tool. It's a tool in the toolbox.
And it's a tool in the toolbox through, there are many ways in which you can use it, but we want to focus on this idea of resets. So basically, in fighting games, when you're doing a combo, sometimes you might stop doing the combo when you're in a really good situation, which confuses your opponent, and maybe you can start a fresh combo, which lets you ignore these restrictions. That's the very simple gist of it. And that interacts with this system because rather than triggering a loop, you might do this instead.
This works on multiple levels as well. Once a player knows that the infinite prevention system exists, they start watching for it. And a lot of fighting games kind of boils down to information overload. There are too many options. So in an ideal situation, given just one option, a player may know what to do. But when there are so many options on the table, they get a bit overloaded. So a player who's watching out for the infinite prevention system activating, the IPS activating, may not notice that they've been reset. They may not even have their hands blocking on the controller, ready to, stop another combo from happening. And they may just take the hit and then be caught in the loop again.
And resets aren't just that. Like, there's a level of mix-up, because in most fighting games you have either attacking, which blocks beat, or throwing, which beat blocks. And so since you know your opponent is probably just holding back during your combo just in case you drop something, then often the reset is with a throw, but not always, of course.
Not always.
Because if they know it's a throw, then they're going to prepare for that.
It is nice because while it is a dominant strategy prevention tool, right? It's the goal of the IPS is to make sure that no one player just dominates the battlefield. And the nice thing is that it keeps the second player involved. They have to be attentive even while they're being comboed. Even while they have no control over the damage the character is taking, how they're being juggled around the screen, they're still looking out for the opportunity to take the turn back. And that keeps both players engaged in the game at the same time. So it's a neat system in that regard.
And this system While you can learn how the repetition system works, it's kind of complex, and it results in some fairly long combos. And it's fairly easy to, in a really long combo, to accidentally trigger it. Like in many fighting games, you learn very prescribed combos that aren't that long. So it's not a super huge challenge to remember all of it. Not trivial, but not super hugely difficult. But in Skullgirls, you might be doing a near loop of a combo for 3 or 4 instances. And at one point, you might be like, oh, use this light kick instead of this light punch, and that will trigger it. There's more room for error in this system, I feel, perhaps.
Error's kind of good from the perspective of keeping a fighting game competitive. You want room for players to make mistakes so that comebacks can happen. And it's a very fine balance, because obviously if the system is too obtuse and like awkward to manage, then it feels random when you even get, you know, your hits in.
And so that is kind of on that edge. Like at high level play, people just know their combos and never accidentally trigger it. As with any high level game for the most part, people just do the things really well. But in that sort of learning the game, like intermediate zone, less the case.
So yeah, that's about all I have to say about this. And for our next game, we move from something very action based, you know, Skullgirls and Smash Brothers, into something a lot more turn based. Cosmic Star Heroine is a Sega CD-inspired retro RPG by Zeboid Games that was released in 2017. It has a fantastically unique cooldown-based battle system where most of your actions go on a cooldown after you use them once and can then only be used again after a rest/defend action. There are moves within the game and on the characters that are reusable and don't need cooldowns, but they tend to be a lot weaker and are more along the lines of your basic attack, which doesn't have any kind of special effects on it.
Yeah, and compared to other cooldowns, so a lot of RPGs are doing something to try and mitigate the standard fight, fight, heal pattern. And in this game, that approach is to give every move one use per a defend action, which has the consequence of also when you recharge your moves, you have to use a defend command to do that, which is really cool because many RPGs are terrible at actually encouraging you to use defend.
It feels really bad to give up a turn just to take less damage. Like defend in the classical sense ignores turn economy. The act of doing something is so much more valuable than taking a defensive stance in most of those cases. Whereas in this one, it's just necessary. Part of the turn economy is just you don't have access to your good moves until you defend.
And your moves have different like priorities and use probably. So most characters have about 8 commands in total they can equip at one time that recycle on rest, which is one of those 8 commands. I think it's about 8 commands anyway.
Yep, 8 to 10.
8 to 10. So characters have these options. And generally they have some distinctly good options at a combat round. Like if you're in an encounter with enemies weak to water, the protagonist starts with a very powerful water attack. So your inclination might be to use that attack many times. And in any other RPG, you would just burn through your MP and use that attack over and over again until it's dead. Sensible choice. In this game, to do that, you would need to do attack, defend, which is obviously not terribly efficient. So you want to find a better way to use your moves to maximize how much you get before you have to spend that defend turn.
And all of this on its own is already, you know, kind of interesting. There's already the inklings of a very interesting, puzzly kind of turn-based system. But on top of that, the game has something called the hyper system,
which is just the icing on the cake for this. Like it just transcends, it makes the system transcendent. The hyper system is every X turns, your character has a turn in which they get access to a powerful mode. Like their moves will do a much higher amount of damage.
I think it's double.
Yeah, it's about double. I think it's influenced by your style as well, which is another resource that you increase by using a variety of moves. So this hyper system gives you a turn in which you know on this turn by X rounds, I want to make sure that I have this move available, which, and that move does not, and this number does not sync up with the amount of actions you have. So your character has 8 to 10 actions, but you get a hyper every sort of 2 to 4 turns, depending on who you're playing. This means that in order to use your best attack every hyper, you might want to use defend commands more frequently but you're also losing out by doing that. So there's a lot of questions in turn economy as to when you want to use that defend command that without hyper is not terribly complicated, but with hyper really makes you question when you're going to do these things.
Without hyper, you deplete all of your one-use abilities, and then you rest. Pretty simple. With hyper, with trying to line these things up, you have to just start juggling so many things. I didn't do very well with that, I have to admit.
It took me a while to get good at doing it. It did lead to its own dominant strategies. So I had a setup that usually led to a third turn party kill with the Gunnermancer. Oh, I love that name. So with the Gunnermancer, you can set them up so they use a very powerful attack against all enemies. So I would buff them with an attack buff, have them set up their thing. When they can do the actual attack, they have an attack buff plus this double-ish damage hyper ability. And for a lot of encounters, it would, if not wipe them out, it would do a good job in doing it. Like maybe one or two hits would finish off many enemies in the encounter. But I get to do that once in a longer combat. And that's the other thing. Like in normal random encounters, or they're not really random encounters, but in most regular enemy fights, you will have dominant strategies. You will have set plans of attack that like, oh, I do this first, and then I do this, and then I do this. And that's kind of fine. Because you gain new moves at a rate that encourages you to use those battles to experiment and feel out what is good about your party. It's fine to have those training battles, I guess.
Yep.
When you hit a boss battle and you have a lot of turns and many hypers to think about and things, that's when this shines, because that is when you actually have to really think about... That's when turn economy matters, because in this game, your enemies also slowly go up in power. I guess we haven't talked about this yet, but there is another meter alongside hyper and HP, which is style. It increases as you fight, and that increases the damage on everything you do. And monsters also have access to a similar thing. So the longer a fight goes for, the more powerful everyone is getting for the most part, which means turn economy matters.
You can't defend forever. Not that you want to anyway, but defending eventually yields less results. Like,
yeah, it'll put you behind the turn economy, so doing powerful attack, defend, is never going to be worth it in a long encounter.
There's a lot that's very smart about the Cosmic Star Heroine's battle system. On top of the fact that you have powerful attacks locked behind a rest option if you want to use it multiple times, a lot of the ways you gain the advantage in a drawn-out encounter is through buffs and debuffs. And, you know, those buffs and debuffs also are locked behind defends in order to refresh them. And so it's just this beautiful juggling act of, I want to deal damage. I want to buff my team to deal more damage. I want to debuff the enemy so that they're less capable. And on top of all that, I have to worry about when hyper is coming up, because that's my opportunity to just push damage. It understands that at the end of the day, damage is the be-all end-all, because if you can end a fight, that's it. It doesn't matter how many buffs you have, how many debuffs your opponent has. It doesn't matter what style is at, so long as you have the damage to take you across the finish line. Because another aspect of the game is that it has a system where you are always at full health once you leave a fight. There is no recurrent. The health values reset once a fight's over.
Health values reset. There's no consumable items. Every item you pick up can be equipped and it can be used once per battle. And some items you can get the ability to use multiple times. But there is no item economy. There isn't a strong economy of like shopping and things. Like there are very few resources you have to worry about. Oh, but the next battle, because that doesn't really factor into it.
Yeah, so the game is really good at putting all of the emphasis on the turn-by-turn tactical burden. And it really eases off on the long-term strategy of, I can't use my good items here, I can't use my good abilities here, because I need it for the next fight. That isn't a consideration in this one. You can go all out in every fight. And when you get into a boss fight, you get to really feel how all out your gameplay can be. And that's a really satisfying feeling.
Like any good system, there's always an exception to it. So fairly early in the game, you can find an item that lets you remove the cooldown from a particular move on a particular character. It's not a super great move, but it hits a weakness, which not many of the reusable moves do. And it's more powerful than a regular like reusable move might be. But there's a lot of like the context of the character it's on prevents it from being too huge. And it adds this interesting dynamic of what's worth more, being able to reuse this move or the stats. And this is a game where stats do matter a decent bit. Like items have a good amount of weight to how much they change your options.
I guess at the end of the day, if you're going to take anything away from this episode, take away that both of us were really pleasantly surprised by how well put together Cosmic Star Heroines system is. There's a lot of things, a lot of small systems that work together in concert beautifully. It's this beautiful ballet and juggling act of different wants and needs that the player will have throughout a combat encounter without making it overly complicated by having you have to keep track of that over many encounters, just focusing on single encounters. It's gorgeous.
And it's really lovely that it's super player driven because cooldowns exist in other games and also do function as fairly effective mitigation things, except they generally are, now that the move's back, I want to use it immediately. This like really makes that repetition mitigation of cooldowns a core part of the system in which all your strategy kind of revolves around, which is a much deeper integration of cooldowns than I think many games that use them really think about. It's one of the few games that we've had to really sit down and say what we're not talking about.
Yeah.
Because we could talk for a long time about this one and get very into the weeds about other things.
But that is mostly it. Those are the games that we wanted to talk about this month.
And let's move on to our ending thoughts. So, in wrapping up, we started with Super Scribblenauts, which gave you very explicit rewards for not repeating the same strategy that you might have had before. Very direct, very blunt, very efficient. Breath of the Wild encouraged you to use different options by slowly whittling down your ability to reuse the same option over and over again through item durability, making sure that you explore the breadth of the system. Smash Brothers Brawl, Super Smash Brothers Brawl even, and the franchise as a whole, encourages you to use different moves by subtly weakening moves after repetition. It's a very soft system that rather than taking away options, just mitigates their power through repetition. It's a little bit subtle perhaps, but it does get its point through.
In comparison, Skullgirls has a very detailed and explicit infinite prevention system that disallows someone from hitting the opponent continuously until their life bar is depleted. And its goal is just to make it so that you have to actually play the game as opposed to sitting there effectively playing DDR. And finally, Cosmic Star Heroine has this beautiful ballet juggling act of intertwining simple systems that basically revolve around the fact that you have powerful moves on a cooldown that you have to defend between using.
And so that's a summary of repetition mitigation of dominant strategies in games. There are lots of different games that we could have talked about, and if you have examples that you want to discuss with us, we'll be happy to hear from you. You can either email us at platformsandpitfalls@gmail.com, talk to us on Twitter, or message us on Twitter just directly through our own social media handles. Also, coming up, we would like to do an addendum episode. So when we make these episodes, we often miss examples or examples come up afterwards, or we've had the discussion and we, in hindsight, realize that we should have talked about X instead of Y. And these addendum episodes are our opportunity to sort of make those corrections, make those adjustments, elaborate on things that we, with the benefit of hindsight, want to talk about more.
The addendum won't be particularly long, and it's really just an opportunity to kind of reflect on a lot of stuff that we've done. But if you have anything that you think that we should have really mentioned explicitly, or if you want to ask us a question about a game or a process that we have used in this podcast, feel free to chuck questions our way. We're not fully sure when this will be going up yet. Don't expect something super long. It's going to be a short one. The opportunity is now open for some of that.
And it'll be a bonus episode, unlike the last addendum, so it won't take away one of our precious slots for the year. So I'm going to give you the hint for next month's episode. Three of the five games are Final Fantasy XIII, Bloodborne, and of course, Final Fantasy VIII.
Of course.
Tell us what you think the topic would be, and if you get it right, you can get some level of personal satisfaction. I'm really interested to see what things you think it might be based on those games. And with that,
thank you for listening.